the information we've provided, silence settling over the room as we await his next words.
Through all of this, no one has explained to me why Bryn was alone in the first place. You're supposed to stay in groups to prevent incidents like this from happening.
I look at Kai. We prepared a suitable excuse, but he doesn't look away from his father when he says, I asked for Bryn's hand in marriage. Messer shifts in place. I don't have to look at him to know he's shocked by the revelation. Judging by the frown on Fallon's face, I can only surmise she's less than pleased by the news. The captain looks toward me, then back to Kai.
And?
Kai looks uncomfortable.
She hasn't said no.
I narrow my eyes on him. Thanks for throwing me under the boat, asshole. I haven't said yes, either. All eyes land on me, and embarrassment burns up my neck and into my cheeks. I'm mortified. The last thing I expected to have to explain is why I'm not jumping at the first chance to marry his son. I needed a moment to process, I say, drowning out my racing heartbeat. The captain sighs, as if annoyed. He stands, pacing a few steps.
What I'm about to divulge to you will need to remain between the people in this room. Understand?
He waits for us to give a nod of acknowledgement.
We suspect Aurora is part of a small uprising here in Alaha. We think she went to the market with the intention to create a disturbance that would break the peace treaty.
We all still at the same time. Then, Messer leans forward in his chair.
Are you sure? Yes,
the captain says.
She hasn't mentioned anything to you three about wanting to cause a rebellion in Alaha?
Aurora tolerates me on a good day, so my answer is easy as I shake my head. Kai does the same. Messer's response is more hesitant.
She's never made it a secret how much she hates the Kenta, he says. But a lot of people voice their distaste for having to rely on Kenta as we do.
The captain folds his arms across his chest as he leans against his desk.
If I could find a way for my people to be more self-sufficient without war, I'd do it. After going back and forth, they've agreed to uphold the peace treaty on one condition. We turn over the two perpetrators who orchestrated the attack against their people, Bryn and Aurora.
Kai goes rigid in his seat.
Not happening. Kai,
the captain reprimands.
No,
Kai says again, no room for negotiation in his tone. Fallon jumps into the conversation.
Listen to your father.
Kai bites his tongue, waiting for his father to continue.
I don't want to do that, knowing your feelings for her, and I've already informed them it's non-negotiable because she's betrothed to my son. They can ask for whoever else they like, but the future leader's wife is not one of them.
My heart stops at the implication.
Plus, we're operating under the narrative that we acted in self-defense. I'm not turning over anyone yet.
And if we don't give in to their demands?
Messer says.
Kenta wants assurances that an uprising isn't happening. I asked them to give us a chance to investigate within our ranks, so by the time the next market comes around, things proceed without incident, which will be 2 years from now instead of one.
I suck in a breath. They're going to starve us out.
We've stocked up enough supplies and food for the next year, and a lot can change in the coming months, so let's not get ahead of ourselves with unnecessary worrying.
The captain's displeasure with the market's events seem outweighed by his son's knee pressing into mine in an effort to soothe my fears.
Besides, we have a matching ceremony to plan.
Messer chokes on his own spit, covering it with a cough when I shoot him a dirty look.
Go. Get some sleep,
the captain says, dismissing us as he walks back around to his side of the desk.
I don't need to remind you that everything we discussed stays inside this room.
His eyes linger on Messer.
I'd hate to have to tell your father.
It's as much as a threat to us as it is to Messer, as he knows the lengths we go to in order to protect our friend.
Good. See you tonight.
We're halfway out the door when Messer stops and says, And Aurora?
What's going to happen to her?
Ren takes a healthy gulp of his drink and says,
That depends on her cooperation.
Knowing we're not going to get more than that, we don't speak until we're outside with the door closed behind us, checking to make sure there's not anyone nearby. Kai scrubs a hand through his hair.
It could have gone worse. Speak for yourself, Messer says. Aurora might get exiled. She knew the risks when she decided to ignite a war. Literally.
Messer sighs.
Knowing Aurora, she'll keep her mouth shut. I don't know if it'll end up helping or hurting her in the end.
He shakes his head, features clearing as he looks to Kai, then me.
I'll see you two lovebirds at the party.
It takes everything in me not to punch him right in his smug face, and he laughs as he strides away. Kai, on the other hand, has the audacity to appear apologetic.
I'm sorry,
he says, pushing the hair off his forehead.
For what? Your parents' disappointment that you asked me, or the fact that it's obviously not my choice to make?
His brows come down to form a frown as he shakes his head.
My parents aren't disappointed in my choosing you, he protests.
I look away from him, taking in the endless, bustling stream of people coming and going along the spiderweb of bridges. I need sleep, I say quietly. He looks as if he means to argue with me, but whatever expression I have on my face makes him think better of it.
Later. We'll talk later.
I leave him without another word. I'm too exhausted and confused and angry to speak. As it stands right now, I can either marry Kai or hand myself over to Kenta as an Alaha rebel. I suppose either of those options is still better than being exiled, but they're somehow equally as unnerving. Chapter 5. It's dusk when I wake. I check the lamp on my bedside table. After a little shake, I confirm that it's empty of oil, but I don't need a lot of light to navigate my space. Smaller than the most single-person fishing vessels, the cylindrical room consists of an open shower next to the latrine, a small sink, and my bed, all within touching distance of one another. Sometimes I forget how unseemly it is, but after being summoned to the home of the captain, it's hard not to be reminded of how little I have. I somehow manage to trudge my way to the corner of my room and under the spigot of my shower, the water blessedly warm from the sun's heat. I take my time scrubbing the layers of sweat and dirt that have accumulated for weeks and weeks. I drain the rain reservoir on my roof to wash my hair. Twice. My bed had looked too inviting to bother with bathing when I first got in, so I just stripped down to my undergarments and fell face first into my pillow. I'm glad I have 4 coppers to my name because I'll add my bedding to the pile of clothes I need to take to the laundress. The sky is dark by the time I'm done and dry. A caw of laughter comes from beyond the curtains of my window, and I hurry to push them open. I'm surprised by the bird's quick appearance. Hey, I say, voice soft. He answers with another squawk, head tilted in invitation for me to give him a scratch. I oblige. There's no way you missed me in that short amount of time, I joke. He scoots closer so he can get his favorite spot. His feathers are black as night, but when they catch the sun just so, they shine with the most gorgeous pearlescent rainbow of colors, blue being the most prominent.
Oh, great. You're back.
Leaning out of my window, I spot Grenadine's gray halo of curls as she looks up at me from the room below.
I'm going to have to listen to that bird squawking at all hours of the day again.
As if offended, the bird opens his mouth and caws, the sound similar to a menacing laugh as his gullet bounces up and down. Grenadine doesn't find it amusing, the wrinkles of her face compressed tight in indignation.
Your pet is a nuisance.
The word pet is exaggerated on purpose, considering the punishment for keeping a pet is rationed food for a month. Food is meant for people, not unsanctioned animals. I retrieve a copper coin and toss it to her.
For your troubles.
Like the bandit she is, Grenadine snatches the coin out of the air and snaps her curtains closed with a scowling smile.
Music begins to play from deep within the grove. The lights of the lamps hanging in windows and along the walking paths reflect off the ocean surface, creating fiery dots atop the rippling black glass below. Voices carry with the wind as people start heading down to the celebration. I grab my pack and climb out the window, onto my roof. I have a view of the grove in almost its entirety, my shield being the highest point in the city. I've always found beauty in the city's complexity, felt pride in our people for surviving in such brutal conditions. But for some reason I can't pinpoint, it feels less impressive looking at it now. Pecking pulls my attention from my melancholy thoughts, and I find the bird attempting to break into my pack. "You are incredibly needy," I tell him, pulling the dried fish he must smell from the bag. "You can have it. I'll be happy if I never eat another fish in my life." This leads me down an even more unpleasant chain of thoughts, because if we are banned from the market for 2 years, there will very likely be lots and lots of fish in my future. Retrieving my sketchbook, I flip through my drawings. There's a memory that's been nagging me since we left the market. I've been fighting the constant desire to sketch it, too afraid while being in such close quarters. I wanted to be able to take my time with it, to lose myself in it entirely. I drew the details a little at a time instead, hiding them in my other drawings so I wouldn't forget them. In between the dresses of the Kenta women, lackluster in black and grays across the paper, between the contours of vendor booths and flags, in the margins, sit the eyes and neck and hands of one man. Even as fresh as my recollection was when I drew them, they don't do his true memory justice. Even so, I have to get it out, regardless of how disappointing I know the end product will be. I flip to a clean page and close my eyes, allowing myself to relive the scene in my head. It's the briefest of images in the middle of the chaos of action, a flash of a moment when I looked over my shoulder and my eyes met his as I ran toward Messer, when the dark-eyed soldier's gaze implored me to stop. I open my eyes and place the charcoal of my pencil against the fresh page, and I begin to draw the soldier on his knees. The bird shuffles closer, finding a spot to roost on my bent knee before falling asleep like he does most times he visits me. Eyes are the hardest. I can get all the other features in perfect proportion, nose, cheeks, chin, but if the eyes fall flat, it's all a waste, so that's where I start. Dark and devious, they look up from underneath the heavy slant of his brows. Anguished and helpless. Angry. Broody. Dangerous. My first rendering doesn't come out too bad, and I expand onto the bridge of his nose and lose all track of time. It's not until the bird takes flight that I snap out of it. Kai's head emerges over the lip of my roof.
"I was wondering if he was hanging around,"
he says, pulling himself up. I close the notebook in my lap. "How are you here?" I ask.
"Everyone is at the celebration, so I was able to sneak off."
He sits with his forearms braced on his knees next to me, gaze weary as he takes in my appearance.
"Did you get some rest?"
I fight a yawn. "What time is it?"
"A little before midnight."
I look him over, dressed in clean linens with his sword displayed on his belt, hair that appears to have been combed into some semblance of order at one point, but is currently hanging messily over his brow. "How'd it go?" He shrugs.
"I spent the better part of the night looking over my shoulder, waiting for my best friend to arrive."
"Kai..."
"It's okay,"
he says with a half smile.
"I was just worried about you. I would have come to check on you sooner, but my father called me in for a meeting."
"Another? More news from Kenta?" He shakes his head.
"They've gotten nowhere with questioning Aurora since this morning, and instead of potentially compromising the information by pushing her too hard, they think she'll lead us right to the uprising if we let her back out among the population."
I raise my eyebrows, surprised.
"You think it's a bad idea?"
"You don't?" He runs a hand through his hair, the culprit responsible for its disarray.
"I think it's risky, but can yield high rewards if we're careful."
"She's a loose cannon."
"She's probably the only reason you're not in Kenta's hands as we speak."
He's right. It could have been Kai or Messer or any one of our people. But I think of the vendors with kind eyes and passing smiles and can't shake the guilt. Gathering the courage with a deep breath, I open my mouth to speak, but Kai's already shaking his head.
No,
he says, the same as he did to his father. I push anyway. It makes the most sense to turn us in. He looks back out at the water, jaw set in unyielding determination.
If we give in this time, we'll have to give in every time. We'll be in the same position next year with someone else.
You don't know that.
I'm not willing to gamble with your life to find out.
My life is insignificant compared to the Alaha as a whole. I'm just an urchin. A flicker of rage ignites behind his eyes, his body twisting toward mine.
Stop saying that.
Kai's anger is rare. He's always composed and articulate and patient. His intense emotion makes me want to leave the conversation where it is, hating confrontation, but I'd never forgive myself if I didn't plead my case. I need to know I tried. Children, Kai. Children are going to go hungry if we don't do something.
My father will find a way.
And what if there is no other way? I say, exasperated. In a few months' time, if there haven't been any successful talks with the Kenta, then will you consider it?
It won't come to that.
But
is the thought of marrying me so abhorrent you'd rather turn yourself over to them instead?
It comes out like a physical blow, knocking the wind out of me and him both. The dejection and hurt are plain in his eyes. I slide my hand over the fist he has on his knee, my fingertips an unspoken invitation, gliding over his knuckles, and he opens his hand, allowing my fingers to weave into his. Marrying you wasn't part of the plan. The anger and hurt from moments before are replaced with hope as he moves closer.
The plan doesn't change.
There's a hitch in my breath as I attempt to rein in the excitement beginning to course through my veins. What about my place in the guard and finding a way onto land? I always hoped I'd be one of the few selected to make the annual trip to the market. A fool's dream, but I wanted it nonetheless.
Everything will be the same as before, except...
He lets out a breath, a tentative smile tugging at his lips.
We'll be together.
A seed of happiness takes root in my chest as the magnitude of what he's saying begins to sink in. But, Kenta...
We'll figure it out,
he says, leaving no room for argument. I nod. He rakes his eyes over my face as if allowing himself to finally take in his fill. I do the same, marveling at the man before me, my best friend, handsome and kind, my future husband. I suppose I can get used to that label. My gaze falls to his mouth, and he follows, his eyes landing on my lips in turn. I don't dare move, but I need him to do something, anything, to put me out of my misery. He brings his other hand to my cheek, angling my face toward his. We've snuck kisses for years, never consistently, nor spoken of afterward, but often enough that I'd always anticipate another while unsure if it would ever happen again. He'd catch me off guard, here on my roof, or while swimming, or hiding behind a corner, some slow and languid, others a quick meeting of lips. But this is different from all the ones before. There's purpose and intent in his eyes. His lips meet mine in a gentle touch before he pulls back.
Breathe,
he says, a wry smile on his lips. So I do, sucking in a lungful of air. Once. Twice. Again. He's witnessed my blush enough that I'm not self-conscious about it with him. Try again? He doesn't wait this time, smiling when his lips touch mine, firm and searching as our breaths converge. A spark of desire cuts through all my trepidation, and I open my mouth up to his, giving him permission. A noise escapes my throat of its own volition, and Kai slides an arm around my waist, pulling me further into his body, his breath as heavy as mine. If I'd had even an inkling of an idea of how good it would feel to imagine a future with him, there would have never been any answer but yes when he asked me to marry him. I know now, and it's like an echo in my head as we kiss. Yes. 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 Chapter 6.
You think the hard part is over because you're almost to graduation?
Gramble strides across the arena, retrieving the cache of wooden swords.
You've gotten complacent. The trip to the market spoiled you, spending all day playing cards and sneaking ale on the ship.
We stand in line, heaving from the last set of strength conditioning. Goats bleat from their stall. They are the noisiest of the animals, always complaining when the paddocks have to be cleared for training every day. The cows may smell the worst, but at least they're quiet. He tosses a sword into each person's chest as he walks down the line.
Yes, I know all about your transgressions.
He's baiting us, damn well aware the voyage was anything but luxurious.
Attack your left. Whoever goes down first has to run laps.
He stands at the furthest end of the line of trainees to observe.
Begin!
It's an all-out battle. I swing the sword with my left arm, aiming for Lawson's exposed kidney. My other hand is in a fist above my head, arm bent to block the blow from Paul on my right that I know is coming. The sword may be wooden, but it's polished and sharpened to perfection. This task is assigned on the regular as punishment for insubordination, and the edge of the training blade sends fire down my forearm. Lawson spins away, the tip of my sword a mere scrape against his back. Paul is quick to disarm his assailant, his attention solely focused on me now.
Didn't know they let traitors stay in the guard.
He sneers in my face. I abandon being Lawson's aggressor as I go on the defensive, sword against sword as I meet Paul's onslaught. He's bigger and stronger than I am. I use it to my advantage, getting inside his reach as I spin into his chest. With my back to him, I jam the sword into Paul's gut behind me. It's a fatal wound, and he's forced to fall back. You were saying? He throws his sword to the arena floor as he accepts defeat. I scan the arena and spot Lawson, who's taken a defensive position against Aurora, retreating back a step with each blow as she advances. It's almost too easy to sneak up behind him, my eyes meeting Aurora's over Lawson's shoulder. Without tipping Lawson off, she angles her next blow to send him right in my direction, and I slice the sword across his throat. He growls out a frustrated yell, and Gramble instructs him to quit whining and start running.
Thanks,
I tell Aurora, but she's already moved on to her next target. I gulp down water from my pack, grateful to be done with today's hellish training session. I do not envy the felled guards who are already running laps around the arena. There are only three people left sparring. Messer against two, Aurora and Philippe, and it appears they have teamed up against Messer in a temporary truce. He's the best swordsman in our class, so it's a smart decision. It doesn't take long for Messer to take down Philippe with a quick juke and slash to the back of the knees. Aurora, on the other hand, seems out for blood. Her attacks become feral, with little rhyme or reason behind her movements, operating on nothing more than blind instinct to try and strike Messer somewhere, anywhere. Messer meets her blows but doesn't counterstrike, and it's obvious he's letting her wear herself out. And, sure enough, her swings begin to lose momentum, and he's able to disarm her. Swordless, she stands before him, chest heaving from exertion. They stare at each other for long moments before Messer picks up her sword, holding it out for her in a show of peace. It feels like everyone waits with bated breath to see if she'll leave him looking like a fool, but Aurora never looks away first. It goes against everything she stands for. Instead, she yanks the sword from his hand and waits for him to walk away before putting her sword away with the others and beginning her laps. Clapping comes from the entrance of the paddocks, and everyone turns to look as Captain Wren, Dupree, and Kai emerge onto the arena floor. It's evident they've been monitoring training from the clock tower above deck. We're at the most northern point of the grove, the easiest place to house the livestock after offloading from the ships and onto the dock. The nearby clock tower can provide the clearest vantage point to mount a defense, if we were ever ambushed. The trainees stand to attention, including the runners, stopping mid-stride to pay their respects. Kai's eyes go straight to mine, and I do my best to appear unfazed by his surprise appearance. We've been sneaking around the past few weeks, finding any hidden moment to be alone, to hold hands, to look at each other without prying eyes, and to kiss. Lots and lots of kissing. It's reckless, we know. I'm pretty sure his parents are aware, but they're willing to play ignorant as long as we don't get caught. The captain wouldn't be able to ignore our indiscretions if it became public knowledge.
You may resume,
Captain Wren says, releasing us.
You've done well training this bunch, Gramble.
Our instructor basks in the praise. If he had feathers, they'd be fluffed to their full glory.
They've been a stubborn lot,
he says in jest. Kai takes in the victors.
Any in particular?
He asks, eyes sliding to mine. He's goading me. Gramble, missing the connotation, declares all of us problem children.
How about one more demonstration?
The captain says.
Your two best swordsmen.
Everyone perks up as Gramble turns his attention to us. As expected, he immediately points to Messer.
You.
He does a quick perusal before landing on Willard.
And you.
A fair match. At least as close as anyone can get to Messer's skill level. Willard is decent. They move to gather their practice swords, but Dupree stops them, removing the sheath of leather from his back and unrolling it to reveal brand new swords. Real ones, with handles made in a variety of shades of copper and bronze and double-edged blades, shiny and sharp.
Choose your weapon,
he says, voice full of gravel. They each look over the selection and pick, Messer preferring bronze over copper.
In the ring,
Gramble instructs. We all follow them to the sparring circle carved into the wood on the arena floor.
You know the drill. First to submit or step over the line concedes the fight.
Everyone is silent as we watch the two opponents enter the ring. The stakes are higher with real swords. It's not that the wooden ones aren't damaging in their own right. I have the scars and bruises to prove they are. But Willard has a tendency to be ruthless in his sparring, and arming him with a truly sharp blade adds a dose of danger to the mix. Messer balances the weapon in his hand, flipping it to and fro in his palm to get used to the weight, then readying his stance across from Willard. Gramble holds an arm outstretched between them, dropping his fist as the signal to start. Willard moves first. Messer expects it and deflects, the blade striking with a loud clank of metal. He follows up with a quick return swing that Willard hurries to parry. Each flurry of movement has me holding my breath, waiting for the final stroke to fall, and praying it's Messer's. It goes on like this for what feels like forever, long enough for the remaining runners to trickle in to watch as they finish their laps. Eventually, battled into exhaustion, Willard misses a step and Messer's able to put pressure on, forcing Willard to concede another step to regain his balance. Messer doesn't relent, attacking with fast strikes that push his opponent over the line and cheers erupt. I cut my hands around my mouth to celebrate his victory. Captain Wren steps into the ring with Kai, and when he raises a hand, the applause dies down.
Each class needs a commander,
he says, hand falling to Messer's shoulder in pride. Kai unstraps the additional holster buckled across his chest, revealing a sword unlike the others. A snake is carved into the golden pommel, its forked tongue splitting into the crossguard where the blade meets the hilt. He holds it across both palms as he bows his head to Messer. Messer looks at the captain, then at his friend and the sword outstretched before him. He must be in shock, staring at the weapon with wide eyes for what feels like an eternity as everyone waits for him to accept his new position. An awkward amount of time passes before the captain says,
"Go ahead. You've earned it."
Messer swallows. Stretching out a hand, he runs his fingers over the golden snake, then pulls them back.
"With all due respect,"
he says, angling his body toward the captain and then Gramble.
"No, I haven't."
A flurry of murmurs zip around the circle.
"If I'm going to be the best, I have to beat the best."
Kai inspects his friend.
"And who do you consider the best?"
Messer turns his head in my direction.
"Brynn."
The murmurs turn into a shower of voices, and Gramble shouts for everyone to be quiet.
"You're the only one who's ever bested me,"
he says.
"Only because you were going easy on me,"
I counter.
"And you were blindfolded."
Smiling a little, he shakes his head.
"You know that's not true."
"Do I?" The two times I was able to defeat him felt like flukes, him making simple mistakes because he wasn't putting in all of his effort.
"A rematch, then,"
Kai says, placing the sword against his back again. I shake my head. It wouldn't be a fair fight when he's already winded.
Oh, I'm still going to win,
Messer says, cocky, swinging his blade to his side.
But at least I'll earn it this time.
Captain Wren gives Messer's shoulder a shake.
Very admirable, son.
He motions for me to step forward, and I force my trembling legs to comply. It's not until I'm standing before Messer that I realize I don't have a sword. Without having to be told, Kai pulls his personal weapon from his waist, gaze reassuring as he holds it out to me by the blade. The chatter from our classmates falls silent. This isn't done. Swords are personal to each guard. They're never shared or traded. The most sacred of belongings to an Alaha. For Kai to offer me his, a commander of his own fleet, the future captain, says more than words ever could. I grasp the gold hilt, the tree embossed along the handle foreign in my palm. It's heavier than I'm used to, and I run through a few practice techniques, shifting it from hand to hand to familiarize myself with it as quickly as I can. I'm here after managing to surpass every challenge designed to weed out the weakest links, after years of defending my place in the guard since I joined at 12. I've been met with skepticism from all sides, from Gramble and my peers to the old hag down the walkway from my room. Taking a deep breath, I meet Messer's stare. An air of mutual respect radiates between us, and I decide, right here and right now, to quit trying to prove myself to people who don't care to know me. Maybe I wouldn't have gotten here without Kai's influence, but I know I've earned this fight. The fact that Messer thinks I'm worthy is more than enough for me, no matter the outcome. Gramble puts his outstretched arm in the ring between us, looking to each of us for a nod of approval, then closes his fist and drops it. I run through attack scenarios, but I know all his counter moves, and he knows mine. We circle each other, smiling because we're both thinking the same thing. Even so, one of us has to make the first move. He jukes in my direction, smile growing wide when I don't even flinch.
Come on, B, he taunts. Show everyone what you got.
I suck on my teeth. You're the one who invited me here. Are you scared?
Of what? Your back?
He deflects my jab with a spin, smiling at the narrow miss.
I was going to say backhand, but the jab is a nice start.
I swing left, then right, and he blocks both, pushing me back with his blade against mine. I attack again, high, low, looking for a gap, but he parries every move. It's annoying. I'm not going to let him take the easy way by wearing me down until it benefits him to counterstrike. I twist into what he wants me to give him, throwing all my strength into my backhand. He throws up his sword just in time, arms shaking from the reverberation when our blades meet. I keep up the pressure, teeth bared as we stare at each other, mere inches separating us. Thought you weren't going to go easy on me. He fights a smile over clenched teeth.
As you wish.
A sharp ting sounds as we push away with our blades, and it's the beginning of an unceasing melody of metal against metal. He doesn't relent, striking and dodging and counter-striking. We flow from one side of the circle to the other in an endless barrage of movement. There's no thinking or planning, like it's often easy for me to do against other opponents. Only instinct and reaction. My purest form of training taking the lead. It's euphoric. We break after some time, chasing air with every breath, and I realize I'm smiling as wide as he is before going back in. I switch hands, giving my dominant arm a break, and he does the same. Left, right, up, back. The blade never stops ringing in my hands. I'm mid-spin, throwing the sword back to my right, when I feel it. The opening I gave him. The resulting sting of the blade meeting the inside of my upper arm isn't surprising. I don't stop my momentum, elbowing him in the ribs instead and swinging back around to jab for his exposed side. He pushes me with a forearm to the chest and I stagger back a few steps. I'm forced to hold my ground against his onslaught. I'm tired. I have to concede a step to stop him from getting past my defenses, and like a shark smelling blood in the water, he advances, Grunting with every block, I defend again and again as he heaves all his power and might behind his weapon. I don't need to look behind me to know the line is at my heels. If I don't do something, he's going to bully me out of the circle. In a last-ditch effort, I leap to the side, rolling into a defensive crouch. Hair falls from my braid, blocking my vision, but I don't dare waste the energy to move it. I'm in a battle of survival at this point, the thin edge of his blade looming closer with every pass. I'm going to lose. I have only one option, a frenzied last chance to push him out of the ring. Mustering all the strength I have left, I let him come at me, blades connecting in a cross between us as he pushes me toward the line with all his might. I let my knees buckle and release my hold on the sword, sliding to the ground so the momentum topples him forward. He jams his blade into the ground to stop his body from going over. Feet planted on either side of my shoulders, blade shoved into the boards above my head, he looks down at me. I'm trapped. Defenseless, without my weapon. Defeated. I didn't expect to win, but it's a bitter feeling to come so close. If there's a consolation prize, it's the fact that Messer looks like he's been to hell and back with me. Sweat pours from his hair in streams, his face and neck a deep red, shirt slashed in a multitude of places. He's panting hard from exertion. I can only imagine what I look like in turn. I feel like literal shit. He reaches a hand down, and I debate the merits of living down here forever, but accept it. It hurts. Messer's smile is soft when he says, "I told you I'd win." I push him, but it's a feeble shove. No one cheers like they did when Messer won his first match. Only Kai enters the ring to greet the victor this time. He eyes me but focuses on Messer, once again presenting him with a sword fit for the new commander. That was an honorable fight. Messer takes the sword in its sheath. "To be Alaha!" Kai nods. "To be Alaha." I retrieve Kai's sword from where I abandoned it on the arena floor. The metal is scorching hot. Blades get hot when they strike each other continuously. Something about friction or energy or other reasons I'm not smart enough to understand. I hold it out to him in the way he offered it to me. By the blade. Apologetic. He accepts it, but doesn't let go, using it as a rope to pull me closer. "I am proud to call you my match." Then he kisses me. In front of everyone, rules and decorum be damned. Whatever punishment awaits, we'll suffer it together. It'll be worth it. Chapter 7. It was not worth it. We spent the night in the brig. The cells are enclosed on all sides with manji stones dredged from the ocean floor. The door, a single wooden plank with a small window secured by iron bars so the guards can check on their captive. There are four cells along the perimeter of the grove, located at the bottom of each watchtower, damp from the seawater that slaps against their stone walls. It's cold and loud and wet. Captain Wren took the time to escort us to our respective cells himself. First Kai, then me. His frown was nothing short of damning as he shut me in. He's furious at Kai's defiance, but it burns extra hot because it's with me. There's always that one couple who gets caught breaching the no-contact rules of engagement, but they usually get kitchen duty or sent to muck out stalls. Then again, they also don't usually do it in front of the captain's face either, father or not. Even after a sleepless, deafening night shivering in the brig, the true punishment begins the next morning. The extra weight of all of Alaha's eyes on me. The whispers and stares follow me everywhere. The taunts had grown quiet during training, but they've been replaced with cold avoidance and harsh glares. Gods forbid the adored and precious son of the captain chooses an urchin as his wife. On the dining platform, Messer slaps his breakfast down in front of mine as he takes his seat. "If you needed to know the secret hideout I use for moonlit trysts, you should have just asked." Aurora rolls her eyes. "Everyone knows about your spot behind the tanner shop." The only reason Messer's never been caught is because everyone avoids the hide shop like the plague, including the night guards. The stench of urine seems to cling to anyone who draws near and is next to impossible to wash out. "Beats spending the night in the brig."
Messer shoves a pile of eggs into his mouth and grins around the bite.
Besides, I haven't had any girls complain.
It brings into question the type of girls you're into, Kai says, sliding into the seat next to me. Good morning. I smile at his unkempt appearance. Is it?
It's my last morning mucking out stalls, so I'd say yes.
An added punishment Ren issued just for his son. He knew the real reason Kai made such a public announcement of his intention to marry me. It makes it more difficult to walk back on once it's public knowledge. Ren needed to give Kai a reminder of his place, beneath his father's thumb. Kai surveys the platform, checking to see if the guards on breakfast duty are watching before squeezing my knee under the table. They're meant to keep a close eye on anyone attempting to swipe food or cause a disruption, but their attention has lingered on Kai and me ever since our transgression, undoubtedly on Captain Wren's orders. How's your arm? I lift the underside for him to see. Almost healed thanks to the ointment you sent to my room.
You can thank Messer, Kai says. He offered to pay for it.
This is news to me, but Messer shrugs it off.
I felt bad after I defeated you so easily.
I scrunch my nose at him. How very humble of you. Kai leans closer, eyes darting to the guards patrolling the edge of the dining space, voice low when he speaks.
Two went missing last night.
Dread fills my stomach. Who? Aurora asks.
Drago and his son.
Kai answers. Messer cusses, pushing his plate away.
That's the third vessel to disappear since the beginning of the year.
Kai nods.
My father is talking about pulling all the fishing exhibitions.
For how long? I ask. His eyes reveal there's not a definitive answer yet. We all pick at our food, appetites gone after hearing Kai's news. It's not uncommon for a boat or two to go missing every year, but it's increased tenfold the last 3 years. We honor our fishermen. Their jobs are dangerous enough. Disappearances at this rate can only mean one thing. Something is taking our people. After breakfast, Messer invites us to a game of poker on the main, which we all decline. He says he might meet a girl later anyway, to fill the void left by his dull friends, he says. Kai tells me he'll see me later, which means he'll find me in my usual spot on my roof, after his shift patrolling with a guard. Aurora doesn't tell us her plans at all. I grab my lantern and sketchbook and climb onto my roof with my bounty. I've been trying to train myself back into my old routine, finding joy in the simple things I did before the market. I used to be satisfied with my charcoal drawings. With nothing to compare them to, I was proud of the odd sketch here and there. But after seeing the art of some of the vendors, I see everything my drawings lack, like pops of color to add depth and dimension where I want it most. Even the deepest shades of black can't convey the darkness of the soldiers' irises. I've drawn and redrawn them over and over, so many times that I'm starting to think they're more of a figment of my imagination than actual memory. I flip to my previous renditions of him to compare, each unfinished and as disappointing as the first. A sound vibrates the air, a heavy baritone that rattles the breath in my lungs. It's a sound I've never heard before, but recognize in an instant. The horn from the watchtower signaling, incoming. I shut off my lantern and shove my things into my pack, launching myself off the roof and back through my window. I tuck the black blade into my waistband and shove my feet into my boots on my way out the door. People are already converging along the walkways outside their homes, eyes turned toward the North Tower, the tower that faces Kenta. I run. It's almost dusk, and lanterns fill the open doorways and light the bridges and pathways. I'm on the opposite side of the grove from the tower. It's going to take me an hour to reach the other side and almost another to reach the bottom level of the city. Unless I eye the distance between my bridge and the one running perpendicular below it. It's doable, I think. It's either that or jump into the water nearly 15 stories below, but it's as daunting a swim as it is a leap between the bridges. I climb over the railing and shimmy down until I'm hanging by my hands. Taking one last glance at the drop, I squeeze my eyes shut and let go. The landing rattles my teeth, but I'm fine otherwise. I drop at the next crossing and the next until I hit the main, then I run the length of it.
Other guards are headed in the same direction. People keep to the sides of the paths, trying to stay out of the way. They're following protocol to seek shelter and hunker down. A sense of panic in the air as people rush to their homes. When I reach the bottom of the northern watchtower, the guards on shift are standing along the bridge and down on the dock, past the brig, where more off-duty guards are congregating. I see Kai standing with his father and Dupree, their backs toward the gathering soldiers as they face the open water. I squeeze through the line of guards only to be met with a disgruntled commander.
No trainees allowed.
I just need to speak to Commander Kai. He points over my head.
Go home before I report you.
I ignore him and yell for Kai. His head snaps in my direction, his father following his line of sight. The captain says something to his son, giving me a nod before turning his gaze back toward the ocean. Kai pulls me to the side.
Brynn, you can't be here.
What's going on? His eyes dart to the closest guard to make sure he's out of hearing range.
There's a Kenta ship on the horizon.
What?
It looks like they're sending a dinghy. As of right now, all we can do is wait for it to get here.
They didn't send word they were coming? He shakes his head.
Go back to your room and wait.
What if I watch from the arena? I'll be out of the way. Sighing, he takes inventory of the guards and how high the paddocks are. I can tell he's close to wavering, so I tack on a please for good measure.
Stay out of sight.
He relents. I nod. Be safe, I tell him, wishing like hell I could touch him. By the way he balls his hands into fists when he turns away, I can tell he wishes the same. The paddocks are clean after being scrubbed, and I claim a spot overlooking the dock. I spot the Kenta ship dead on the horizon, sitting where the sky meets the water, where the water starts to blur with the setting sun. A smaller boat with one lone figure rows toward us, the distance making it difficult to distinguish more than a man with short hair. Darkness falls, and he hasn't yet made it to the dock. But still, we wait, all eyes trained on the small portion of ocean reflecting the lights of the grove. We wait, and wait, and wait, until a single shot of light travels into the sky in the distance, exploding into white sparks above. A signal from the Kenta ship that they come in peace. As if on cue, the small boat slowly comes into the light, and my heart stops, comes to a complete halt because... No, there's no way it's him. I'm imagining things. It's dark. All men look the same in the dark. Except this man is unmistakable in his stature and beauty. Even with just a glance at his profile, I know it's him. Five guards stand waiting as he pulls his boat to the dock. He passes up a rope to tie off as he reaches overhead to climb the ladder, raising his hands into submission the moment his feet are on the dock. The leading guard's voice can scarcely be heard above the waves as he orders the man to his knees. All the while, my heart is in my throat. There's no way he'd come all the way here for a knife, would he? If I'm caught with it, I'll actually be the thief he accused me of being. I have to get rid of it. I swear I can feel it hum against my waist, as if it's reacting to its owner being so near. And, as if hearing its call, the Kenta soldier's head snaps up, eyes landing on mine in the same breath. Kai likely knows what's holding the soldier's attention without needing to look up. He stalks toward the man who forced my hand to the wall and has haunted my thoughts ever since, and stands before him, demanding his attention. The soldier doesn't so much as blink. The other guards take notice, heads beginning to swivel up to see what's caught his attention. My position has officially been compromised. Kai leans over to intercept his line of vision. I see the soldier say something, lips moving as his eyes remain on mine. I gasp when Kai punches him across the face. The dark-eyed soldier's head whips to the side, and he spits on the dock before finally giving Kai his attention. And his smile. The guards haul the soldier up, placing shackles around his feet and wrists. They direct him to the captain, who addresses him. Whatever the soldier replies clearly doesn't sit well with Captain Wren, his face turning stern with anger. He directs the guards to take the soldier the rest of the way to the brig. They pass directly underneath the paddocks, and the soldier's gaze once again finds mine. Just a single moment of contact before he disappears into the cell. But the lingering look stays with me the entire walk back home. He wasn't outright smiling, but something pulls at the corners of his eyes, bright as they met mine. Like he finds this amusing. Finds me amusing. I spend the night in and out of restless dreams about the soldier and the wall at the market and wildflowers in a meadow, grass whipping in the wind like a sea of green. Chapter 8. Messer's gaze locks on mine as soon as I step onto the dining hall's platform, and we each make a beeline for the other. My eyes shift when I spot the deep purple bruise shading his jaw, the mottled skin continuing beneath the collar of his shirt. "Messer," I utter, taking him in. He shakes his head, eyes going to guards nearby before pulling me into the food line. We carry our plates to the furthest part of the platform, overlooking the ocean and giving us a perfect view of the Kenta ship still moored on the horizon. We've been on a temporary lockdown since the ship's arrival, and this is the first time I've seen him in 3 days. I wait until a guard walks past before pinning Messer with my eyes. "What happened?" "He caught me sneaking out, but I'm fine." He stabs the eggs on his plate. "Have you spoken to Kai?" he asks, stepping over the conversation about his father. I'm surprised he admitted as much. Training has been put on hold for the time being, so there's nothing else to blame for the injuries, like he usually does. I can't say there's anyone I harbor more hatred for than I do for Messer's father. Messer's eyes all but beg for me to let it go, so I do, forcing myself to take a bite of food and swallow before answering. "No? Have you?" He surveys the crowded platform, lips thinning in worry as he shakes his head.
"I haven't seen Aurora either."
"You haven't heard anything from your father?" His father is third in command, next in rank to Dupree. He's definitely in the know as to what's going on. He shakes his head.
"He's not exactly happy with me right now."
"There are what, 30, 40 men on that ship?" He eyes the blurry silhouette on the horizon.
"If that.
They'd be cut down before ever stepping foot in the grove."
"I don't think they're here for retribution,"
he says. "They've been sending out birds every day. Do you think Ren was being honest about the terms Kenta gave us?"
"I don't know what to think,"
he says, glancing up at me.
"But I know they're keeping a tight perimeter around the North Tower, so they still have that Kenta soldier in custody."
Another guard makes his round, passing by our table. "You know how I used that soldier's blade?" I don't need to elaborate. Messer loads his fork and shoves it into his mouth, nodding without looking at me. I keep my eyes on the food as I speak under my breath. "I may still have it." There's a definitive pause from his side of the table before he's able to regain his composure. He takes a swallow of water from his water skin, then addresses my confession.
"Get rid of it,"
he says. Voice absolute. No room for negotiation. I know any of the excuses I'd give him for not having done so already would be feeble. I've spent every waking moment since the Kenta soldier's arrival worried sick about Alaha guards storming my shield and finding evidence of my thievery, but I haven't been able to make myself do it. It doesn't matter that I admire the Black Blade and the craftsmanship that went into it. It's not a keepsake, nor mine to begin with, so I dip my head in acquiescence. We eat as slowly as we can while waiting to see if Kai will appear for breakfast, but time runs out and we have to report for training. Although the grove is attempting to return to some sense of normality, people congregate in clusters, their whispers floating through the leaves of the trees on the wind. The main is open. Shop doors are propped open, but no one is shopping today. The clerks linger in the doorways as people pass by. There's a game of piranha happening. Kids giggle and scatter from the two chosen as the attack fish. They'll tag others in a bid to grow their school of hunters, but as we descend upon the group, their lack of enthusiasm is evident. Their voices quieter, laughter less joyful. Messer leaps into the fray, throwing his arms around a few of them at once, causing a ruckus of screams to break out. He helps them to chase down the remainder of the free fish until there are none left. Sherlane, the primary school teacher, comes to admonish Messer and the children, her coiffed hair and steely eyes as scary as they were when we were children. Bowing his head, Messer dips out, but not without a smile hanging from his lips. His deviation causes us to have to rush the remainder of the way to the paddocks. The bell of the clock tower chimes 9 times, indicating the changing of shifts and the end of breakfast. Gramble is already barking orders when we reach the top step.
"Give me 100 for being late,"
he says, pointing to the dirty arena floor. Due to the temporary lockdown on the Grove, no one has scrubbed the arena in days, but there's no time to contemplate the dung and urine coating the ground as we fall straight into conditioning. I give Messer a less than pleased glare, muck sliding through my fingers with every down movement. He at least looks repentant. I'm 37 push-ups into my set when Gramble calls my name. Sitting back on my knees, I look up to find him and Dupree standing at the entrance. The scary-looking commander gestures for me to come with a wave of his hand. Messer lifts a questioning brow at me, and I shake my head in response. I concentrate on picking up my pack and placing one foot in front of the other. Dupree doesn't speak a word as he turns and leads me down the stairs of the paddock. I grab a water skin and rinse my hands on the way down. Captain Wren awaits at the bottom.
"Bryn."
He greets me. There's a polite smile on his face, but there's a note of seriousness underlying it.
"I apologize for having to pull you from training, but I'm in need of you."
"Of course," I say, hoping I seem amenable despite the desire to flee coursing through my veins.
"This way."
I'm ushered to walk in front as we take the path toward the North Tower. Kai comes into view outside the brig, and his scowl doesn't do anything to ease my quivering nerves. The captain stops me with a hand on my shoulder, and I fight the urge to step out of his reach. He turns me toward him while we're still out of hearing range of the cell. He senses my hesitation.
"No one is in trouble."
He smiles, giving me reassurance.
"I've brought you here because I need you to speak to the soldier."
I'm taken aback. "Me?"
"Yes. All inquiries we've sent to the Kentership have gone unreturned, and the soldier is adamant that the only person he'll speak to is you."
I look back at Kai, but he gives nothing away.
"All you need to do is go in there and listen to what he came here to say,"
says the captain, drawing my attention again.
"He might try to manipulate or bait you into getting emotional, but don't let him."
"To be clear," I say, holding his gaze, "you want me to go in there and listen?" By the slight flicker in his expression, I can tell there's more before he speaks again.
"The Kenta have an armada of ships that we need the location of."
"You think they're headed here?"
"I don't know,"
he says, eyes going to the lone ship on the horizon.
"But we need to know if this soldier and the soldiers on that ship are rebels of their own making or if we need to be prepared for something else."
This is a lot of pressure. The thought of speaking to the soldier sends a fissure of equal parts excitement and unease down my spine. My chest is tight, and my heart pounds, but I can't possibly say no, not to the captain's request or for the sake of my people. "Okay," I tell him. Captain Wren smiles. It's so rare to see it directed towards me that it stuns me for a moment. But there's no time to soak it in before I'm marching toward Kai. He's dressed in his commander's uniform.
"I'm going in with you."
I nod, relieved.
"If you want to leave at any moment, say so and we will."
I can't find any words, so I simply nod again, hiding the shake in my hands as I fist them at my sides. Kai reaches for the iron door handle, but one of the guards stops him with a hand on his chest.
"No weapons inside."
Confused, Kai looks down at his sword, then at his father. Captain Wren gives him an affirming nod to obey, and Kai unbuckles the weapon from his waist and hands it over.
"Sorry, sir, but no weapons inside,"
the guard orders again. Kai goes still, as do I when I watch him lift the material of his shirt from his less dominant side and produce a dagger. It's a prohibited weapon. Wren looks less than pleased by his son's insubordination, but no one says a word as Kai holds the weapon by the blade for the guard to take. Reaching for my hand, Kai laces his fingers with mine. Ready? I let his steady presence center me, taking a deep breath before nodding to the guards. They open the door and Kai steps in first, body angled in front of mine as he leads me inside. The smell hits me first, worse than the paddocks. The kind of stench that seeps into every pore of your lungs, a constant reminder of the human condition. Nothing could have prepared me for the stark difference between the last time I saw him and now. One eye is nearly swollen shut, the other bloodshot around the pupil, with a deep cut slashing across the brow. His nose is scabbed over where his nose ring once was. It hurts for me to lock eyes with him. He smiles, teeth stark white against his bruised skin.
It's nice to see you again.
Even though the words are directed toward Kai, we both know he meant it for me. Only me. The familiar bang of the cell door closing sounds behind us. We're locked in with the soldier. I do my best to put on a brave face. Wish I could say the same. His nostrils flare, eyes heating as he looks from me to Kai.
The Alaha work their young guards with the animals.
There's no mistaking the smell of cow shit clinging to me, and I hate the humiliation threatening to make itself known through the burning in my cheeks.
Be careful casting judgment.
Kai's words are coated with ice.
We're limited on space, so we're forced to use the paddocks as a training arena.
His stare lingers on Kai.
Can you explain why this cell was covered in her scent when I arrived here?
Shock spikes through my system. He could smell? Surely not. A guard had to have let it slip, or he overheard a conversation. I look to Kai, but his gaze remains on the soldier, glaring at him like he's little more than scum on his boot.
We're not here to explain ourselves to you.
That's right. We have a deal.
The soldier turns his dark eyes back on me.
I wanted to apologize.
His voice is level, without a trace of hidden meaning behind it. Or it's hidden very well. Either way, it's unsettling.
I didn't mean to hurt you that day in the market. I've never experienced that pain myself, but I've heard stories of it, and none of them are pleasant.
I think about it all the time. How it felt like something living, like another entity invaded my body for the split second of connection I had to the earth. It's strange, because it happened so fast it almost doesn't seem real anymore. Like, maybe it never happened at all. It couldn't be any worse than if you'd taken off my hand instead. He lifts a brow. Or worse than what has happened to you here. He severs the connection between us, eyes going to Kai, and my gaze follows, realization dawning. Kai? I step forward so he's forced to look at me. I grab his arm. He stops me with a hand over mine where I grip his shirt.
He's manipulating you, Bryn.
The captain warned me he'd do this, try to get in my head and confuse me. Embarrassing, really, to let him do it so easily. I turn my attention back to the disheveled prisoner. He's watching us both closely, eyes lingering on the way Kai's hand covers mine. I release my hold, suddenly eager to get out of this cell. Where is the armada? The dark-eyed soldier settles back against the wall, head propped against the stacked stones.
The largest portion is moored in Old Tide Bay. They keep a ship or two at the market, a few remaining out at sea. They switch out from time to time, but it's difficult to say when that'll be.
Well, that was easy. Too easy. But Kai seems satisfied, already leading me to the door by my elbow, knocking to signal the guards outside that we're done. I dare a glance at the soldier before I'm ushered out. I'm either more gullible than I thought, or there's something like unfettered concern in his eyes as he watches us leave.
Until next time, Bryn.
The way he says my name, the last letter lingering on the tip of his tongue, sends a spike of fear through me. He says it like he's not finished with me. Chapter 9. I'm careful to keep to the shadows underneath the shields, Guards have been patrolling strict, rotating shifts, issuing warning to anyone not obeying the curfew. They've caught a couple of adolescents sneaking around, but they were spared from the brigs. Lucky them. I stop on the first story, next to the southern watchtower, keeping close to the structure to remain out of sight of the guards above. It's been raining on and off for days, but there are thankfully no whitecaps on the water. I double-check my surroundings before making sure the blade on my hip is secure. Then, I step off the ledge and plunge into the ocean, keeping my arms and legs together to minimize water disturbance. I swim to the ladder hanging from underneath the main. It's slick and covered in barnacles and algae, but I manage to get onto the structure of support beams that make up the underside of the bridge. The beams aren't in any better shape. I slip with every step, the darkness swallowing up the space within a couple feet in front of me. I consider turning back. The bridge spans the entire width of the grove, and going at this pace, I might not make it there before daylight. Still, the endless worry in my stomach pushes me to take another step, to get answers, but also to help, if I can. I spend the next couple of hours shuffling along the crisscrossed beams, one side of the bridge to the other, praying that every additional step isn't going to be the one to plunge me into the ocean below. It's not a far swim to the fishing docks, but it's one of the grove's most patrolled areas due to teenagers sneaking out to the fishing boats at night. It's not until I'm within arm's length of the brig that I realize I've made it. By the grace of the gods, I've made it. Bracing my hands against the mangy stones, I allow my muscles a moment of reprieve. I don't, however, remind myself that I still have to make the trek back and am already on borrowed time. The sun can't be but an hour away from peeking over the horizon, which means I'm 3 hours away from having to report to training. I peek through the cracks in the stacked stones. Light from a lantern hanging on the other side of the wooden door comes through the bars of the window, outlining one of the guards standing nearby. My eyes land on the figure leaning against the opposite wall, facing me. His knee is bent, chained arms hanging over the top of it. He appears to be sleeping with the back of his head braced against the wall. The light flickers along one side of his body,